Good evening. I would like to call the House Ways and Means Committee to order. Today is May 1st, 2024. The record reflect the 6:01 p.m. Today we have present Speaker Tilton, Representative McKay, Representative Groh, Representative Gray, and myself, Chair Carpenter. Thank you for joining us tonight. We do have a hard stop at 7 p.m. I'd like to remind everybody to silence your cell phones. Staff assisting us tonight will be Lori with House Records and Shelby with the LIO. My staff, Kendra, will be the committee aide. So we began this session, and let the record reflect that Representative Allard is here as well. We began this session with a look at a model presented by our Legislative Finance Division on what the current budget looks like and the direction that the state is heading in relation to long-term fiscal plans and different options that we could take to help fill a budget deficit going forward. And as this will be the final Ways and Means meeting of the year, of this session and of the legislature, it's fitting and appropriate that we take a look at where our budget is as we consider the amendments and the positions that we've taken and what it looks like going forward in relation to long-term planning. So I've asked Director Painter to come and take us through the same fiscal model that we used at the beginning of the session to kind of put into a big picture reference of what our budget looks like and the direction we're headed now. So with that, I'd like to invite Director Painter to the table. Sir, if you would put yourself on the record and show us where we're at and where we're going.
Thank you. For the record, Alexi Painter, Director of the Legislative Finance Division. So to update the model from previously, there's changes on both the revenue and budget side. We'll actually start with the revenue tab. We received the DOR spring forecast since the last time this model was updated. That forecast had slightly higher oil prices, but not other significant changes. In FY25, we went from a projected price of $76 to a projected price of $78. So not a huge difference, a little bit more of an increase in FY24, but in the out years, there was maybe a $1 or $2 change a year. So it was not a major change on the revenue side. It is a little bit more revenue in every year though. So if you're comparing to the previous model, it is slightly higher. The bigger changes are on the budget side.
Can you go back 1 second? I just want to characterize the assumptions that we're making or the projections we're making on the out years for revenue. How would you describe that chart there on the right-hand side that talks about revenue summary?
Mr. Chairman, so this is the non-percent of market value draw of revenue, so our traditional oil and gas revenue, as well as the existing, it says fall of 2023, but the non-oil revenue. And that's based on the Department of Revenue's spring revenue forecasts, which calls for prices dropping from the current year, where they're expecting $82.39 for the year in FY24. That's the year we're in. And then dropping to around the $70 range for the out years. That's based on the futures market as of March when they did the forecast. Since then, prices have been a little bit higher than the forecast, but the futures market hasn't changed a whole lot. I would note that $70 is kind of an important number for our production tax. So there's the impact of the forecast going up and above and below 70 is actually fairly significant because of the what's called the graduation requirement from the gross value reduction that depends on $70 oil. So it's just, you know, having the forecast going above and below makes it a little hard to understand some of what's going on in the details of oil and gas. But essentially, they're calling for reduction in prices from the current level down to the $70 range, and then an increase in production. So in the current year, FY24, DOR projects 470,000 barrels. That's projected to begin going up when the Pikka field would come online somewhere in FY27 or 28, and then further when the Willow field would come online in FY32 or 33. So there's some increases in production. The revenue does start to increase a bit at that point, but the real revenue impact to those fields will be after the carry forward losses have been exhausted for Pikka, and then after, sort of right away with Willow, we'll see an upturn in revenue due to that field. But with the way the production tax works, it's not kind of an immediate spike, and it's also offsetting production declines in the existing fields. So you do see that increase in revenue and increase in production in the out years, but there's definitely a period of kind of flatter revenue. So overall, we see for oil and for the non-POMV revenue, no year in the forecast is higher than FY24. So we're not even keeping pace with inflation if you look at just the non-POMV revenue because of the projected decrease in the price.
Thank you. And what is the takeaway with the assumptions on where we're headed with the POMV revenue?
So, Mr. Chairman, that sort of shows up on the budget side. We don't have that separate. Actually, I'll show on the summary. So the POMV revenue, the permanent funds forecast actually did slightly increase the spring forecast. So they're projecting over 7% returns. I can't remember the exact number off the top of my head now. And that's supposed to rise from about $3.65 billion in FY25 to $4.3 billion by FY33. So that will be increasing significantly, about the rate of inflation. So overall, the projection is our revenue would go from about $6.5 billion to $7.3 billion, with that increase mostly coming from the percent of market value draw going up over time.
Okay, thank you. Question, Representative Gray and then Representative Grohl.
Thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Painter. My question is really about how accurate and how reliable some of the numbers are. Like when we say that the price per barrel in FY30 will be $69 per barrel and the price in FY33 will be $73 a barrel, how accurate have we been in the past at predicting oil prices 6, 7, 8, 9 years out?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, not very accurate. The oil market is dynamic. And it really, we have a requirement in statute to have a 10-year plan. And so that's often the time frame we look at. In terms of the oil market, 10 years is a very, very long time. Going even 1 or 2 years, we have significant volatility. The goal of fiscal planning is sometimes to figure out how do we ride that volatility and get through that. I would say that where the forecast landed being around $70 is somewhat close to like the 10-year average price. So this year it's kind of coincidentally the 10-year average of the price over the last 10 years is about $70, I think it's $71. And then that's about the forecast. So coincidentally, we've landed on a time when we're somewhat in the middle of the range. We've had years where, 2 years ago, the revenue forecast was $100 a barrel. Prices dipped very quickly at that point. There's a lot of volatility in there for sure.
We'll get to you in just 1 second. I want to thank you immensely for asking that question, because it gets to the heart of the conversation that we're going to have tonight regarding deficits, because we're assuming, and there's nothing wrong with that, we have to make assumptions. We're assuming that the price of oil is going to stay somewhere around $70 a barrel, and we're assuming that production is going to be increasing going to the right on the calendar, right, as the years go by. So, and then we're also assuming that the POMV is going to continue to increase. And so if those assumptions, to your point, don't turn out to be exactly what we thought they were going to be or what we assumed them to be, then the deficit information that we're going to have is going to look much differently. Representative Grohl.
I was saying the deficit will go higher.
Representative Grohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have several questions, Mr. Container. Once again, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for arranging this last meeting.
Can you move closer to the mic?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
I think it's worth it to talk a little bit, make sure that the committee understands and we all have it clear in our heads what you said about the oil fields. You said with PICA there would be a it would come online in certain years. If it was afterwards because of certain features of our tax law, that it would actually bring more revenue. Could you give those years again, please, for PICA?
Through the chair, Representative Groves, so it's expected to come online somewhere around FY27. The Department of Revenue has kind of a risking methodology, so they don't assume 100% of the forecast. You know, the forecast doesn't say PICA goes from zero to full production in 27. They kind of spread that over a few years. The way the production tax works is there's what's called the gross value reduction for new fields, where for the first initial years of a field's production, they have a 20% gross value reduction, but also their per barrel credit is capped at $5 a barrel. That gross value reduction lasts either 3 years that prices are $70 or above, or up to 7 years that prices are below $70. So when you have years where prices are exactly 70 in the forecast and then they go down to 69, you would see the graduation, as it's called, from the gross value reduction be extended. So you'd see, like in the forecast, if you ran the forecast at $70 in FY30 and 31, you'd see higher revenue because that field would graduate from the GVR sooner and would pay more in tax. So riding that $70 line can be a little confusing, I think, sometimes for actually showing how much revenue we get from the field. Sometimes I wish they would just do the forecast at like a flat $70 and then a $69 forecast, because you'd be able to see that impact of that provision more clearly. But yeah, that's a significant one. And, you know, in the case of a field that is a new operator, they can't deduct their costs as they develop the well. As they develop the field, they generate carried forward losses and credits that can be used against their production when they come online. For an operator that has an existing field, they can take those deductions as they go. So, like, you know, this is all public, so I'm not, you know, no taxpayer confidentiality. I don't have special information. But, you know, with PICA, that operator does not have an existing large field. So those presumably their costs will be taken out of their production tax when they start producing. With Willow, that has ConocoPhillips, that already has a large field, they can take some of their costs as they're spending it. So we see that revenue deduction as they're developing the field. So you see a different timing between those two fields in terms of how that impacts our revenue. So with PICA, you don't see that full revenue impact year one, but you'd see it a few years later. With Conoco, you see a negative, or sorry, not Conoco, with Willow, you see a negative revenue impact until the point where it hits production, and then you see a positive revenue impact because they go from having just expenses to suddenly producing and then revenue to take those costs against.
In the interest of time, I know we're going to walk a fine line of getting down in the weeds and understanding this. I'm going to help us make sure we get through the presentation. Representative Groves.
One is, I know a lot of talk about how we're going to get a lot more oil in Alaska. I note in your graphic, the highest oil production per day in your graphic is in FY33 at 633 million, 633,000 barrels a day, well below the million barrels, and obviously far, far below the 2 million barrels that we had going through the pipeline late 1980s. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes.
The last question is, I've seen these graphics off and on over a 40-year period. Sometimes they include a break-even price. I'm not seeing it here. Am I missing it?
Through the chair, I'm going to go for production.
A price of oil that would make the budget balance.
Through the chair, I'm going to go, I think, yeah, I mean, this is the revenue tab. We don't have that in,
okay,
in this. We usually put that in the fiscal summary for each given year. But, you know, we have to make that dynamic as you change other things in the models.
Right, I would also argue that in the past we did not have a break-even point on a size of dividend or how much of the permanent fund earnings are being spent towards the state budget as well.
What is the break-even price this current fiscal year and the one for next, as you projected?
Through the share reps, it depends on where the budget lands. So
what is it for this? What was it for this year?
For FY 24. So the I'm just trying to think of how to handle the energy relief payment.
Okay.
It was somewhere with the budget that was appropriated. It was somewhere in the neighborhood before supplementals of 76 dollars with the new forecast.
Okay.
I want to say.
Good. I'm
trying to go pre-supplementals. We've been okay. In the supplemental world.
But obviously, given the projections, way higher in future years as a break-even price.
Well, through the share reference grow, sorry. I'd have to do the math in my head. In the current year, we have a lot of those costs from the Willow field against the production tax. And in the current year, we have a 75-25 dividend. In future years, it depends on
right. Again,
what you're receiving. So.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please continue.
Okay, so.
Moving to the budget piece.
Moving to budget. So we have a lot more options than we did before. So I'll start with supplementals. So the first is the governor's amended budget, the supplementals. The next, I guess, adjusted basis doesn't exist. Next would be the House. That's very similar. And then the next is the Senate. That includes their Senate, the capital supplementals. Since I put this model together last week, the Senate, the House Finance Committee put out their version of the capital budget that matches the supplementals from the capital budget in the Senate. So I think going forward, I'm going to just use that Senate finance number as the placeholder. But I would note that our assumption is something like $50 million a year in supplementals. This year we're at currently $337 million. A lot of that is because of what I'll get to when we talk about the capital budget, that really we should be looking at session by session rather than fiscal year by fiscal year. But some of it's also things that are actually addressed in this year's budget. So we have the largest supplemental this year is for fire suppression. The other body's budget includes a $35 million increase to fire suppression for the upcoming year to try to get us out of the cycle of supplementals and move towards an average funding. Both bodies' budgets, the next largest supplementals for the Department of Corrections, both bodies' budget includes significant increases to the Department of Corrections to get their FY25 budget to match their 24 with supplementals. The last few years, their budget after supplementals has been higher than their budget for the upcoming year. So there are some actions that are taken in the 25 budget to try to maybe reduce those supplementals in the future, but I would still note that disparity is pretty significant. And I'll get to the capital items when we get down there. So starting with agency operations, so our base is government plus. That's including the amendments that we've received. The last batch was April 9th. We're still expecting some amendments from the governor relating to contracts. You probably all heard that the university union agreed to a contract. We do not have an amendment for that. We expect one in the coming days. There are three other unions that are outstanding for FY25. Those are not yet in the governor's numbers or in the other body's budget or this body's budget. So when we're looking at the operating budget numbers, keep in mind that even what we see as government, House, Senate, you know, we're day 107, 108. We're still going to see those numbers go up most likely as those contracts are worked in when we get to that conference committee number. So the House number for the budget is significantly higher. So government was $4,345,000,000. The House came in at $4,581.3 million. The biggest difference is the outside the formula money for education, about $175 million. That makes up the vast majority of the agency operations difference. The Senate Finance Committee is very close to the House, about $20 million over. That's also the Senate budget now, as they did not amend it on the floor, about $4.6 billion. So again, compared to the governor's budget, each of these are about $250 million above, with the bulk of that $175 coming from that outside the formula money for education. Going down to statewide items, so starting with the governor's budget, the big change that's been made in these, other than the Senate moving where they're budgeting fire suppression, which I won't cover, is the disaster relief fund. The governor put in $5 million. Both bodies put in $20.5 million, which is the average amount that is needed for the disaster relief, spent from the disaster relief fund. So the governor's number may have resulted in a need for a supplemental. We obviously don't know what disasters are coming this year, but both bodies, again, trying to reduce the amount of future supplementals, came up with putting in a number that represents the average spend to try to break the cycle of supplementals every time there's a disaster. The other statewide items, I have GovMend number, 6.4 of things that I'm not listing here. The House number is actually much higher. A lot of that is in community assistance. I'm just, for simplicity, putting that all down here. That's the Senate number. House number is a little bit higher because of community assistance, where the House put in the amount needed to get back to a $90 million balance. The Senate number is higher. The largest, up to $80 million, a lot of that is because they moved fire suppression out of the Department of Natural Resources and into a new fund, or not a new fund, it's actually an old fund that hasn't been used since 1989, but was the way we used to fund it. So that moves that expense from agency operations down to statewide items. Again, I'll just leave Senate for now. I know this is the other body, but just to, you know, use kind of the most recent version of the budget to pass, I'll use that one. For the capital budget, the governor's number was $297.4 million with amendments. I think last time we looked, it was slightly higher, $305. That actually went down through his amendments. The Senate's budget was at $271, including the mental health capital budget. The agreement had been for the $100 million of ads in the it's like a budge versus budget. That should be capital budget. Sorry. So it's that would be adding $100 million. The version that the Senate Finance or House Finance Committee came out with today went over to about $103 million. The Senate had left a few million dollars on the table. The House used that to fund a governor's project that came in too late for the Senate to include, that split somewhat between House and Senate funding. So the real number of that is going to be a little bit higher, it looks like, maybe 374 point something. And here's where I talk about the capital budget. So for the operating budget, we often look at it fiscal year by fiscal year. The capital budget, really the most accurate way to look at it is session by session. The legislature can move money between the years pretty freely on the capital budget because you have that long project life. Capital projects exist either for 5 years if they are not making progress or the entire life of the project. We have capital projects on the books that have been there for two decades. So oftentimes the capital projects will be funded in the supplemental year if that's where the revenue exists, or they'll be funded in the current year. In this case, the other body's budget, the capital budget, funded their additions to the capital budget as supplementals, and then this body budget included their additions to the capital budget in FY25. That's not to say the other body didn't add to the capital budget. They just added in a different year. And a lot of times, really, the most accurate way to look at the capital budget is really session by session, because when we have spikes in revenue that get spent, we see that spent across the two fiscal years, not necessarily in just the current fiscal year or upcoming fiscal year. So that's a bit of a challenge to our modeling here, where, you know, our baseline is this year's capital budget grows with inflation. Well, if we do this session's capital budget grows with inflation, you'd see this 371 plus the Senate and House Finance Committee have $193 million of supplementals. So, you know, $550 million of, or 500 more than that with the governor's supplementals of capital spending. We're just reflecting the FY25 approach growing with inflation. But really, if you wanted to reflect the size of this capital budget going forward, you'd really kind of need to add $193 million to this. If you don't do that, then really you're talking about decreasing the capital budget going forward from what was agreed to this year. Now, of course, the capital budget tends to shift based on how much available revenue there is. So, you know, the fact that oil prices are higher today and then are projected to go down, that probably indicates a smaller capital budget. But it is a significant challenge for fiscal planning that the capital budget crosses fiscal years and then just varies based on our revenue rather than having some sort of baseline based on needs. So again, just flagging that as a concern for you who are trying to do fiscal planning, figuring out what's a reasonable size of a capital budget to assume going forward is definitely a challenge. And one we've really struggled with in the Legislative Finance Division, where we're trying to say, what's the baseline? We don't know what a baseline capital budget is. We just know what you spend when you have a given amount of revenue.
Director Painter, since we're on the capital budget at the moment, there was, if I'm not mistaken, money appropriated to FY24 budget from the capital spend. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chairman, yes. And so that's reflected up here in the supplementals. But I think if we want to, you know, for modeling purposes, say, well, we're going to keep that level of spend going forward, you know, you could add it starting in FY26, that those supplementals would get moved forward. And anything below that's really a cut from what the legislature is planning to appropriate for this year. So
the supplemental number up at the top includes both capital and operating.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, for simplicity, I put it up there, but really, you know, it does cross both budgets. So then finally, we have the dividend. So starting with the governor's number of 50% of the current statute, so 50% of the statutory net income. So if we had, we're kind of the legislature, the Senate's ending up, but then the governor's dividend, you'd have a $1.3 billion deficit that would grow significantly over the coming years because we're assuming the budget grows with inflation, but as we kind of talked about already, revenue is not assumed to grow with inflation. If you change to, I'll just start with the 50% of percent of market value, and again, there's the Senate's budget starting point, you have a deficit of roughly $900 million in FY25, growing the average deficit over this period from 25 through 33 is about $1.45 billion with this scenario. You go to the other body's proposal, which is 25% of the percent of market value. That leaves you with a surplus in FY25, but deficits in the outgoing years, assuming, again, you're keeping the capital budget at the same level as this year and the operating budget growing with inflation. So even at the 75-25, if we're keeping the capital budget at this level, we would expect significant deficits. If you assumed we just did the FY25 level, not the 24 session level, you'd have smaller deficits, about $250 million a year, but you'd still have deficits. So this kind of gets to the point, I think, that Mr. Chairman, you had your staff had me put together a comparison between the model a year ago and the model now. And so we can switch to that sheet if you want now, unless there's questions about this.
It's fine. I would also request that the 193 stay in there just for the sake of argument here, showing a thing going forward.
Oh, and one other provision I should put in. So the energy relief is another one. So this body's energy relief boosts the amount in FY24. So that uses that FY24 surplus. That doesn't have any impact going forward, but does have an impact on sort of your reserve level. So I'll put that in again, kind of a Senate plus House mishmash here, but just to try to, you know, show level or numbers, I suppose. Well,
the mishmash is what happens in conference committee. So
sure, that's correct. And you know, oftentimes a conference committee, you end up higher than either body's budget. This year, that's not really possible because that would leave a deficit. So it's going to have to go below the Senate number when you consider the contracts that have yet to come in, as well as fiscal notes. So I guess before I turn to the other sheet, I'll just touch on what I mentioned before about, you know, so if you use the Senate Finance Committee budget as a base, what's in there and what's not at this point? What's not in there is fiscal notes. There was one bill with a significant fiscal note that the legislature has already passed, the broadband bill, that cost $39.4 million, so I'll put that in. The other one that appears likely to pass as a large fiscal note is the senior benefits extension, that's $23.5 million. If you add just those two, that's almost $63 million. That appears likely to be ongoing spending going forward. Beyond that, we have these four union contracts. We have one has come in so far. The other three supposedly are close, and we will see in the next week and potentially be added in the conference committee. The placeholder we used a few weeks ago was $26 million, just including the three that are not the university. University, I think the UGF impact of that is like $1 or $2 million. So just for the sake of having a number in there, let's plug in $27 million. We had $26 million, the placeholder for kind of the low end of the contract. So let's bump that to 27 as the low end. Then other fiscal notes, other bills that might pass. I think the number I showed in the Finance Committee was like $13 million. There's now an elections omnibus bill moving that has a significant capital fiscal note, so might go up, but let's just use that. So $103 million is a placeholder. That's likely the likely additions to the Senate budget going forward through the end of the year with fiscal notes and the new contracts coming in. So that's where I say conference committee needs to get below the Senate number in the operating budget. Even with the Senate's dividend, we show a small deficit. That's including supplementals that shows that deficit. So we show that they're a bit overspent. At
this point. Just to be clear, those are recurring costs, not a one-time cost.
Sure. Yeah, that's correct. And with those union contracts, you know, we'll see how they're structured. They may be, you know, weighted more heavily towards later years. You know, we saw the state troopers came in with a contract that is 7%, then 3%, then 10% in the third year. We could see something like that. We don't know. We haven't seen them yet. Again, that's part of why projections are hard. We don't have all the information. But again, I'm just going to plug that number in just so you can kind of see that. And so even with, you know, the other body's budget with their dividend, 75-25, you'd still show a deficit in 25. So we're going to have to get below the Senate budget at the end of the year. I think that's probably significant to understand that there's not a conference committee that can go above both bodies like in some years. It's going to have to get somewhere closer to the House budget or at least below the Senate. Okay, so turning to that other sheet, this is without those additions, and I put this together pretty quickly just to show. So the model I presented this committee a year ago versus this model, just kind of some reasonable ballpark.
Can you scroll down to the bar graph there on the summary and step us through that in just a minute?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Before I turn over, I will do that. So the bar graph shows the lines are the budget, the bars are revenue that makes up to that budget. So the top line is the budget including the PFD. And you can see that the traditional revenue and PO and VDRA are not quite sufficient to meet our spending in this scenario. You would need to draw from the CBR and SBR that we project under this scenario. You'd run out somewhere in FY30 and start having an unfilled deficit. We're not assuming right now that it gets filled with the ERA. It's just a hole. If you assume it gets filled with the ERA, that eats into what's available in the ERA balance going forward. So it kind of looks weird on the map because we assume that you have to stop inflation proofing to run the graph, because you have to stop inflation proofing to make room for that. Otherwise, you go negative.
And we're assuming at this point that the PFD split is what in those outer years where there's a deficit?
Mr. Chairman, this is a 75-25.
Okay. What would it need to be in order to balance those in the out years? If we're assuming that the spending is similar to what it is this year in both operation and capital, and then where would we need to be with regard to the PFD or the split of the permanent fund earnings to balance the budget?
Gotta go lower. Mr. Chairman's trying to eyeball it because I added some things from before. So I think we'd be at about 11%. Something like 11% of the percent of market value draw going to the dividend, based on all of these kind of added spending we've added here, including that, higher capital budget, these contracts and fiscal notes and so forth. That shows a significant surplus this year. And then because, you know, we're showing the budget growing with inflation and revenue not growing with inflation, that goes to a deficit, but over the period, that's about a balanced budget, is, you know, an 11% POMV. That would be a PFD per person of something like $600 a year.
And I guess the good question to ask at this point is, if you return the assumptions on the PFD to a 25-75, and then the question would be, going back there, what other options do we have right now to fill those budget deficits in the out years, assuming the budget stays, assumptions stay the same?
Mr. Chairman, that essentially, if we're assuming that dividend level and no budgetary changes, that leaves new revenue of some sort.
Okay. Okay, please continue. We got about 20 minutes.
Okay, so The sheet, I think, that's handed out to you compares the model a year ago to this year's model, not with quite all the additions to the spending that we've put in so far. So based on the first comparison is revenue, we're showing slightly higher revenue in this year's forecast than last year's forecast. Prices are up significantly, but also costs are up that have eaten into that somewhat. But overall, in FY25, it's something like $200 million more revenue, decreasing to, you know, under $100 million by the end of the modeling period. The budget, comparing what kind of the baseline assumption in that model from a year ago was the one of the versions of the Senate's budget that was the most recent at the time, plus the governor's capital budget, because they hadn't rolled out their capital budget yet. That showed about a $5 billion budget in FY24, growing to 5.1. With supplementals, the other body's budget is closer to 5.6 billion, and then 5.5 billion in FY25. Again, this is before you add those placeholders we've talked about and the capital in the out years. So for the budget, we're in FY25 and going forward, something in the neighborhood of $350 to $400 million higher than what we had assumed a year ago based on the other body's budget. And a lot of that is on the capital side. Some of it's on the operating side as well. Both of those are significantly higher than they were a year ago. So netting the two on the next line, higher revenue but lower or higher budget, means we have, before the PFD is considered, a lower surplus.
You're going over this sheet right here. Sure. You can direct your attention to the committee. This is the sheet that he's looking at right now. Do we have that available on the digits? Take a brief at ease so that we can get it up on for the public to see. We have the document up for viewing pleasure. And Mr. Painter, please continue.
All right. So I was on the kind of middle where we're comparing the difference between the surplus before the PFD a year ago versus in the model today. So kind of those things, the higher budget, higher revenue net out to in FY25, $172 million difference on average between the periods, about a $233 million larger deficit, again, before the PFD. If you include a 50-50 PFD, the difference actually grows to about $400 million a year, because one of the offsetting things is we're assuming better returns in the permanent fund and therefore higher PFDs from the 50-50 or 75-25. So, you know, before PFD, you get a smaller difference than once you include that. Then if you, so with the 50-50 a year ago, we said that was something like a $660 million deficit, on average 800 over the period. Now it's about 1.5 billion. So significantly higher. I think numbers didn't add up right. So there's something's wrong in these numbers. I did this pretty quickly. This number is not right. It's not 1.5. It's definitely more like 1.2 billion. Yeah, that number got copied. I apologize. I put this together very quickly.
Thank you for doing so.
So be about a $1.2 billion deficit on average. With the 75-25 a year ago, we said that would lead to an average surplus of about $205 million. Now we'd say that leads to an average deficit of $227 million, so $400 million difference roughly. Again, that's, we have a higher revenue amount, but also significantly higher spending. And now that's leading to a higher now a deficit, whereas before it looked like if you did that, you wouldn't have to do anything else. Now it looks like if you did that, you would need additional actions. And a year ago, the POMV going to the dividend that would give you an average zero deficit was something like 29.5%. This year, with those assumptions, without kind of those additions I went through, it'd be something like 19% as we went through. If you add the contracts, the fiscal notes, the higher capital budget we had this year, that number could drop to something like 11%. Again, assuming no other changes.
Chairman? Representative Groh.
Let's describe this a little more if we could, Mr. Chairman. Director Painter, can you just set out a little more carefully or slowly what percentage of the P1B to dividend for zero means? What's happening there?
So through the chair, Representative Groh, so if we're assuming that the budget doesn't change, revenue changes, and we're just trying to get to an average of the average deficit of zero from FY25 through 32. So in this period we're modeling, we want there to be on average a balanced budget.
So the 4-0 means 4-0 deficit.
Yes, for a zero average deficit from
I'm not reading the whole thing. Thank you.
Sorry. Could have had a box around or something to make it easier. So it's for to balance the budget on average. So last year we'd say if you put 29.5% of the dividend or the POMV draw towards the dividend, that would balance your budget. Now that number is more like 19%. And again, as we showed earlier, if you add some of the things that are not really in our baseline assumptions, like the parts of the budget that aren't there yet, contracts, et cetera, you could lower that even more. And again, that the core reason we see that is that revenue is not increasing as fast as inflation. So if we assume the budget grows with inflation and revenue does not, you get ever increasing deficits going forward. And Mr. Chairman, I think that's all the things I had to say, unless there's other questions about the model, the things I was supposed to touch on and did not.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Okay. Representative Groh.
Mr. Chairman, I mentioned what you think this means. That's the most interesting question to me, because we have worked in this committee, and I want to thank you again for the work that you've had us do to bring forward revenue measures, to discuss them, to analyze their effects, to look at other fiscal measures. But I'd be really interested, Mr. Chairman, what is your view of what is occurring here?
Well, Representative Groh, I appreciate you asking, and I don't mind sharing. I think if Director Painter scrolls that down just a little bit, and the graph here is kind of what I've been speaking to for a couple of years now, that the process that we go through with regard to our budgeting is going to lead to the consumption of the permanent fund dividend, and this chart shows why that's going to happen. If we continue doing the things that we're doing now without any systemic change to how we do things. So there's a lot of what ifs here, right? So we're what ifing the oil price, production amount, we're what ifing returns from the stock market and investments, basically all of the different investments from the permanent fund earnings or from the permanent fund and in assuming an increasing earnings. And all of those could be different and likely are going to be different in the future from what we're projecting. What it means to me is that we continue to make a decision to balance the budget on the back of the dividend, using it because it's the easiest thing to use to balance the budget. And if we continue to do that, we will reach a point in time where there is not enough permanent fund earnings to balance the demands for spending, and then we will have a decision to make as to whether we continue to spend at a certain level and increase revenue, or live within our means without a dividend, and adjust the spending, and that is rapidly approaching within just a couple of years, assuming things stay the same within the legislature. So that is what it means to me. And we're going to wrap up and end here just a little bit early. Appreciate the lead in. I want to say thank you to Director Painter for coming in and showing us this modeling. It's very helpful to me, and I hope it's helpful to the public and the rest of the legislature. I want to say thank you to the committee members for your work this year and working in good faith to move forward components of a fiscal plan. I know it's hard to get a comprehensive plan through this legislature, and we've made a good faith effort to make that happen, I think. And I would hope that in the future, that effort gains traction and we have future conversations in future legislatures, because this is going to make some Alaskans very unhappy that we are putting together budgets and doing things the way we're doing, knowing full well that we're still going to have deficits in the future and we're not changing anything structurally to make sure that doesn't happen in the future. And anyway, so I thank you all for your time and participation this year. And I think unless there's any other comments or questions from the committee, we will adjourn today. It is 6:47 p.m. and that's a wrap.